CMA Morning Show with Charlie James.
Good morning. 10 minutes past 7 o'clock on the Big Talker 1250 WTMA, WTMA.com. Happy Monday morning to you. Well, the star of the Emmy Awards last night was obviously President Donald Trump. Everybody talked about him, and Stephen Colbert even brought out Sean Spicer last night.
What really matters to Donald Trump is ratings. You got to have the big numbers. And I certainly hope we achieve that tonight. Unfortunately, at this point, we have no way of knowing how big our audience is. I mean, is there anyone who could say how big the audience is? Sean, do you know?
This will be the largest audience to witness an Emmys, period. Both in person and around the world.
Wow, that really soothes my fragile ego. I can understand why you'd want one of these guys around. Melissa McCarthy, everybody, give it up. Robert De Niro's in the front row. He's nominated, of course, for his role in Wizard of Lies, which I believe was the Sean Spicer story. Thank you again for being here, Sean.
There you go. Why do Republicans, conservatives, think that they can go on some of these shows and be treated fairly? Now, first of all, I'm very upset that Sean Spicer took the opportunity for the 69th Emmy Awards to get on there and slam his former boss and to mock and ridicule his former boss. That to me. Way to go, Sean. Way to go. But I don't understand why they go on The View. I don't understand why they even go on CNN. Now, I know why Lindsey Graham and John McCain do. But for other right-thinking conservatives, I don't even know why they show up. Hey, would you like to come be on, MSNBC with Joe Scarborough? No, you know what? I think I got some paint I need to watch dry. I would rather do that than show up on that show. But they're constant. I mean, Stacey Dash did it. Well, it was last year, wasn't it? When they had the lease, when was that? When did Chris Rock do the Emmys? When they were complaining, or maybe it was at the Oscars or whatever. There was not enough diversity in these shows. So this year, they said last night, it was the most diverse group of nominees ever. So if you won an award last night, it may not have been because of your performance. It may have just been because of diversity and political correctness. And the politically correct award goes to... So, that's... I want to see these ratings on this show. I really do. I want to see how well or unwell they did last night. I'm pretty sure they're going to be down. Because, I mean, Colbert said it's just going to be Trump, which was a dog whistle to me saying, don't watch.
It's Charlie James on 1250 WTMA.
I think 2017 is going to be known for a lot of things. Some of the storms that we've had, of course, the inauguration of Donald J. Trump as the president of the United States, the 45th president, the year that Hillary Clinton continued to whine about why she lost when everybody knows. But I think maybe it might be the worst year ever for the evolution of blue jeans. Now, so far, we know that designers have made $425 jeans that were pre-stained with mud. Remember that? That was beautiful. They came out with totally crotchless jeans, and they came out with jeans that zip down the back to expose your butt crack. Thankfully, none of those ever really took off. Now there's a designer named Natasha Zinko. She has created something called double jeans. Why, Charlie, what are these double jeans of which you are telling us? Well, they look like you put on a pair of jeans over another pair of jeans. Yeah, that's right. This is the brilliant thing they're doing. And listen to this. Here's the most interesting part of all. They are selling for $700. $700. Dollars. So if you're dying for them right now, you can always just put on two pair of jeans and look like an idiot without spending a single extra dime. How about that? Well, I tell you what, I don't understand fashion. I'm so glad I don't understand fashion. Jeans that look like you're wearing two pair of jeans. What in the world? Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, there you go. That's the world in which we live in. People are going to pay seven. I want to see somebody pay $700 for these jeans. I want you to fess up if you've done that. All right, 556-1250 is the number to be on the program this morning. That's 556-1250. Weekend box office looks like It, the clown movie from Stephen King, is number one again. It's brought in $60 million this weekend. That's up to $218.7 million in its second week. A lot of people are going to see that. American Assassin brought in $14.8 million. And Mother brought in $7.5 million. Now, what is this movie Mother about? Well, this movie is apparently the mother of all bad movies. In fact, several people saying this is the worst movie they've ever seen in their life. Rex Reed said Mother is the worst movie of the century. It's so bad that people are actually walking out because of their anger at how bad this movie is. Of course, it's with Jennifer Lawrence. And she was the one that came out recently and really besmirched or insulted the president of the United States. And apparently she is just basically box office poison. She cannot get a hit. So go see. I'm sure that'll be straight to video soon. $7 million. They're not going to recoup their losses there. All right. 556-1250 is the number to be on the program this morning. That's 556-1250. This is, you know, talking about that movie, It, and this whole clown thing. Remember that? It was last year. We started seeing all these clown sightings, and it was clown this and clown that. Well, up in Boardman, Ohio, police say that a father, I don't understand what's going on in this guy's head. A father wore a clown mask and chased his six-year-old daughter around the neighborhood, which resulted in gunfire from a neighbor. His name was Vernon Barrett Jr. and said he was only trying to discipline his daughter by putting on a clown mask and chasing her through the neighborhood. This according to the police report. Police say the six-year-old girl jumped into a stranger's car and then ran down the street and into a stranger's apartment. Reportedly screamed to the family in the apartment that a clown was chasing her. When the family looked out the window, they saw the girl's father wearing the clown mask. A guy fired a shot out of his window. Luckily, he missed Barrett. Barrett was charged with child endangerment and inducing panic, while Santiago was charged with using weapons while intoxicated. Not a good thing to do. Police say that Barrett claimed that the girl's mother is serving time in jail for child endangerment after being convicted of breaking four of the girl's ribs. This poor girl. Not only do you have an abusive mother, now you got an abusive father. Barrett said that his daughter was having behavioral issues. Well, I wonder why. I wonder why this kid would have behavior. Could anybody out there come up with a reason why this kid would have behavioral issues? I don't understand. Seems like a perfectly fine home she's living in there. He decided to scare her as discipline instead of spanking her because that's what her mother did. Wow, this poor child. I just cannot imagine that home or what this kid is going through. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. 556-1250 is the number to be on the program this morning. That's 556-1250. Do not forget the 4K a day on WTMA. Your chance to win $1,000 next is coming up at 9 o'clock. That's your next chance to win $1,000. We'll be doing it four times a day. $20,000 will be given away this week. $20,000. Somebody's going to win. Well, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money right there. So right around 9 o'clock, we'll tell you the word to text and where to text it to. You do that, and then we'll text you a confirmation email, and you will be entered to win $1,000 this morning. Yep, it pays to listen to 1250 WTMA. We'll talk more about the Emmys last night and the incredible anti-Trump fest. And what happens when you say the word boobs on CNN? Well, apparently, they lose their minds. That's coming up next.
The TMA Morning Show with Charlie James.
It's 7:39, 21 minutes until 8 o'clock on The Big Talker, 1250 WTMA, WTMA.com. Well, I guess if you are a liberal, you can pretty much do whatever you want to over on CNN. It doesn't really matter. But if you are a conservative, well, they've got different standards for you over there. Listen to this exchange that happened on CNN with Brooke Baldwin. Here we go.
I believe completely in the First Amendment and in boobs. Those are the only two things I believe 100% in this country. And by the way, Jamel has absolutely nothing to do with her background
CNN,
at all.
Speaking,
immediately, did you notice that? He went straight to that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I did go straight to that.
Why would you even say that live on national television and with a female host?
I say it live on the radio all the time because it's true and that's what I do. Because I like boobs and the First Amendment, which is exactly what I said.
I'm sorry.
To have her anatomy brought up, to have anyone's anatomy brought up in this conversation.
I'm done. This is done. This is conversation over. Yanking mics. Bye. See ya. That was entirely inappropriate, and it just took me. Forgive me that it took me a second. It's like live television happens, and you think you hear something, but you're not entirely sure, and then you realize it happened. So I apologize.
There you go. Fox Sports Radio's Clay Travis, who describes himself as a First Amendment absolutist, says, I believe in the First Amendment and boobs. So Brooke Baldwin cut Travis off, saying, I just wanted to make sure I heard you correctly. As a woman anchoring this show, what did you just say? And so she was completely taken aback by that. However, her moral high ground seems to be shrinking in elevation, because if you go back, all you have to do is go back to, what was it, countdown to 2016 over on CNN. You remember this a couple of years ago when Don Lemon was basically drunk on the air, and that's when they had Kathy Griffin on there. Don Lemon made a couple of pretty blatant sexual innuendos during that program, which Brooke Baldwin had no problem with whatsoever with that. Also went on to say that Kathy Griffin had a nice rack. Brooke Baldwin didn't bat an eye. No. It could have been because, they were imbibing in alcohol, adult beverages, we will say. So, and, you know, it's absolutely fine for them to do that. But if you're a conservative talk show host, then, you know, all of a sudden, there's moral outrage. Let's go out to Mount Pleasant and talk to Gene this morning. Gene, how are you, buddy?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you this morning?
Good. What's up?
Well, flooding. I've been around here quite a while. And
yeah.
All that area along Brittlebank Park to Joe Riley, that used to all be marsh.
Right.
And all the area up the Cooper River where they want to build that big development, that was all marsh.
Yeah.
And so you wonder why we flood. I mean, the water used to be able to go into those marsh areas.
Exactly. And that's what we've been saying for the past couple of weeks here. Listen, you have basically built a large portion of this town on swamps and marshland, and then you get shocked when it floods?
Right.
I don't get it. But then, I mean, we see these people doing it a couple of hundred years ago, you know, down on Market Street and over on Calhoun, and you go, well, you know, maybe they didn't know better back then. Maybe they didn't have, you know, they weren't as technologically advanced as we are now. But now it seems like we're doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, when they started filling that where Brittlebank Park is, their intention was to go all the way up to Cosgrove.
Mm.
And if you look at a long-range plan of the Citadel, the front gate was going to come in from the Ashley Riverside and have a 9-hole golf course out there.
Mm.
I was a student at Citadel then. And
oh, really?
It was amazing.
Yeah, it's unbelievable that that all of a sudden we're having a problem with flooding when I think any common sense thinking individual will say, well, don't build on swamps and you might not have as bad a situation. Paul is out in Somerville and wants to talk about the CNN boobs remark. Good morning, Paul.
Top of the morning to you.
Yes, sir.
I don't know if it's necessarily even a political thing. I think what it comes down to is that there's a lot of extremely liberal women who are much more comfortable with men who aren't so manly.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Don Lemon, listen, I've been a high school teacher for a long time, and I have some former female students who could walk up and down his bony behind there. No question.
Right.
Okay. And, you know, and the thing is, it's like, I mean, I agree with the guy about the First Amendment. People should be free to say whatever the heck they want.
Yeah.
Otherwise, unless you're threatening somebody, okay, otherwise, leave it alone. Because speech is not violence. That's nonsense. Speech is speech. You're saying something.
Right.
I mean, look, I live in a neighborhood where they allow you to have flags out front there, because that's a form of speech.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't care what flag anybody in my neighborhood flies. They can fly the rainbow flag. They could fly the bloody ISIS flag. Don't give a rat's rear end.
Right.
Don't care. You know, it's like, it's a big country, lots of people in it, lots of different points of view. You can't accept that, well, then find another place to live then, I guess.
And especially find another profession to be in. If your business thrives off the First Amendment, why are you pro anybody else shutting it down? They should be the first people to speak up and say, listen, this is the wrong thing to do. And, of course, we're talking about what has been going on college campuses all over the country now.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I was, speaking of which, I was glad to see that one of those conservative fellows did get to speak at Berkeley.
Yeah.
And you know, and the local authorities finally got their heads out of their hindquarters and realized, hey, we shouldn't just let people throw rocks and firebombs because they disagree with somebody. You
yeah.
know, again, that's violence.
And you know how they did it, Paul. You know how they did it. And it was a great thing that they did. They basically banned people wearing masks.
Well, exactly.
During those protests.
Here's the thing. I could have sworn that after they passed the law that the Klan couldn't wear masks in public because
yeah.
they're a violent organization, that it pretty much applied to everyone.
Everybody. You are exactly right.
Really?
Exactly right. I mean, it's amazing how they, who are, you know, Klan this and Klan that, how they are actually taking the trappings of the Klan and of ISIS.
Well, so. Yeah, I can't help but notice, too, that most of these Antifa, they, you know, I was wondering, why does it remind me of something from my childhood? Then I realized, oh, my God, yes, they're Cobra, the enemy for G.I. Joe.
That's right. You are exactly right. They're Cobra.
WTMA.
Now, the TMA Morning Show continues with Charlie James.
Good morning. It's 7:51 at the Big Talker, 1250 WTMA. WTMA.com. Glad to have you along with us on the program this morning. 556-1250 is the number if you would like to join us. Maria is forecast to rapidly strengthen over the next couple of days as it takes aim at the Caribbean islands. Now, this is one of those that we don't know where it's going to go quite yet as far as affecting us here in South Carolina. And, of course, on the eastern United States, there is some significant strengthening that's forecast during the next 48 hours. Maria is expected to become a very dangerous major hurricane before it moves through the Leeward Islands. It's according to the National Hurricane Center and their latest update as of 5 o'clock this morning. The Hurricane Center placed Maria about 100 miles east of Martinique and about 130 miles east of Dominica. It's currently a hurricane, Category 1 hurricane, winds up to 90 miles an hour. That's going to continue moving toward the eastern Caribbean at about 13 miles an hour. Likely to be a Category 3 or 4 by the time it hits the northeastern Caribbean Sea, and we are talking about a 3, maybe Wednesday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Of course, this is give or take. I know from experience, you can't really tell how quickly a storm is going to move on you, especially when you're in Puerto Rico. So right when it hits Puerto Rico, it's going to be a Category 3 hurricane. Now, this one is a little more south of where Irma was when I was in San Juan. So the governor of Puerto Rico is saying that this could be a more substantial storm than was Irma. Just, my gosh, doesn't it seem like Irma was a month ago? It was only a week ago today that we started really having the effects of Irma. It's now, Maria's one of three storms that's out in the Atlantic right now. It is the one that poses the most danger to the hurricane-battered Caribbean. on the forecast track, the center of Maria is going to move across the Leeward Islands late today and into tonight, and then over those the North Caribbean Sea tomorrow and tomorrow night, picking up all of that energy from the warm water down there in the Caribbean. A tropical storm warning is in effect for Antigua and Barbuda. No real need to give a warning for Barbuda because, as we told you on Friday, there are no living human beings on the island of Barbuda. This is the first time in 300 years that it is completely uninhabited. Also, the island of Saba, St. Eustatius, and St. Lucia, a warning is they issue those about 36 hours out. So more storms in the Atlantic. And again, we're going to have to wait and see if this thing takes that northerly trek to come right on up the eastern coast of the United States. And again, the question still remains. I've asked this question 1,000 times. Does it follow our coastline, or has our coastline been simply worn away over the years because of the effects of these hurricanes? I would go with the latter, right? I mean, if you see them always taking, and look, I mean, they'll either go into the Gulf or up the eastern United States, and they seem to follow this path. So I don't know. I mean, I just haven't had a good explanation of that. Maybe the Gulf is the way the Gulf is because of storms over the millennia, and the eastern coast of the United States as well. So more storms to keep lookout for. And now's a great time to download the WTMA Hurricane Preparedness Guide. Seriously, we hope that Irma did not catch you unawares. We don't want Maria to do the same thing. We want to make sure you're ready. So download the WTMA Hurricane Preparedness Guide from WTMA.com. It's free. A lot of life-saving information on there. And it's brought to you in part by Property Casualty Insurers Association of America, Jeff Cook Real Estate, and East Bay Deli. So go ahead and get your hurricane guide right now at WTMA.com. All right, 556-1250 is the number to be on the program this morning. That's 556-1250. Of course, last night, the Emmys, the 69th Emmy Awards. And we saw the person who won last night was John Lithgow. I thought he really deserved to win an Emmy for his portrayal of Winston Churchill in The Crown. What a brilliant job he did. I mean, it's just absolutely fantastic. If you haven't watched The Crown, you need to do so because it's really, really fascinating. But of course, they took every opportunity to slam the president last night. And then basically, Donald Trump was the star of the show last night. Here's Alec Baldwin.
I suppose I should say, at long last, Mr. President, here is your Emmy. I want to thank my wife. My wife and I had 3 children in 3 years, and we didn't have a child last year during the SNL season. I wonder if there's a correlation there. All you men out there, you put that orange wig on, it's birth control, trust me.
There you go. So every opportunity they could take to take a shot at the president. Oh, and who was the, I can't remember the girl's name, Catherine McKenna, something like that, from Saturday Night Live. She took the opportunity to thank Hillary Clinton for her courage and her grit last night. Ooh, it was just a big love fest for Hillary and a big hate fest for the president. I cannot wait until these ratings come out. Can't wait to see them. I am predicting they're going to be pretty darn low. I think they're going to be low because I know a lot. I mean, I was watching Twitter and Facebook and all last night, and everybody was saying, I'm not watching that mess. I got paint to watch dry. All right, 556-1250 is the number to be on the program this morning. Coming up at 8:40, we're going to be talking with Brad Owens. Brad is a contractor with the government, and he was on the ground in Benghazi back in 2012. When all of that took place, we'll talk to him. We're going to ask him whether or not he ever felt safe while he was in Benghazi, because we are hearing that some government contractors were basically told to shut up. Just sit down and shut up. You are not to, you mention a word about Benghazi, and this is your last government contract you'll ever have. We had some information about that come out. We'll talk to Brad Owens. But now, you know, we got a new president, we got a new administration, so these folks are now talking. Also, the Day of Giving is coming up tomorrow. We're going to be talking with Bill Sandvig about that. And we will also be talking with Olympian Laurie Hernandez. She's going to be at the Southern Women's Show this weekend. She is an Olympic gold medalist, only 17 years old. 17 years old. She's an Olympic gymnast, and we'll be talking with her. That's going to be a lot of fun.
The TMA Morning Show with Charlie James.
Man, I just love that guitar riff there. Los Lonely Boys, How Far Is Heaven? It's 11 minutes until 8 o'clock on The Big Talker, 1250 WTMA, WTMA.com. Clemson is a numero dos in the college football rankings. Alabama's at number one. They were made the same. Basically, Clemson and Oklahoma swapped places. Clemson now moving to number two. Oklahoma's at number three in both the AP and the coaches poll. Clemson had a good weekend against Louisville. I thought it was going to be a little closer game than it was. Louisville, no slouches out there. South Carolina still unranked right now after their loss to Kentucky. Georgia, I have to talk about them because they're my team. Georgia moved up two places in the AP poll to number 11. They're number 12 on the coaches poll. And they get to play Mississippi State this weekend. And man, oh man, what Mississippi State did to LSU on Saturday, that I don't want to say that was surprising, but when you see a powerhouse like LSU ever losing a game, it's always kind of a surprise. So anyway, Clemson is number two. All you Clemson fans, very, very excited out there. And I know some of you South Carolina fans are concerned about Deebo Samuel. He had surgery on his leg yesterday. Well, Muschamp said that he's going to miss an extended period of time playing. He is the SEC's touchdown leader. Now, Muschamp said Saturday that Samuel's leg was broken and he would miss the rest of the season. On Sunday, he said that Samuel's surgery went well and we'll wait to see how the recovery goes. So Samuel and his mother went on Twitter shortly after the game and said that he will miss 5 or 6 weeks and return toward the end of the season. I think that's pretty optimistic, unfortunately, for you Gamecocks fans. I think that's pretty optimistic. A broken leg is not something you easily come back from. So, at least in one season. I'm sure he'll be back next year and in fine form. But big loss for the Gamecocks. Samuel got his sixth touchdown of the season, had a 68-yard catch, and he leads the SEC and is tied for second nationally. So, let me ask you something. Did you see the flop? Did you see the flop this weekend? You didn't see that? Yeah. Yeah. Jake Bentley did a flop this weekend. Now, the flops are something, if you follow soccer at all, is like if somebody touches you, you fall down, and you hope to get the red card, you know, you hope to get the red card. But apparently this guy just brushed past Jake Bentley during the game with Kentucky. And Jake Bentley did. Oh, he should have won an Emmy. He should have won an Emmy for this flop. They should have been giving him something last night at the Emmy Awards. Stephen Colbert should have personally presented that award for the best flop of this season in football so far. He looked like he got hit by a truck. He really did. It looked like he just got plowed over by a truck, but he was, in fact, just brushed against. He was trying to draw a penalty there, but did not work on the refs. So, Jake, you need to maybe take some improv classes, some acting classes, so you can learn how to do that. Maybe go take a wrestling class, because that's the first thing they teach you in wrestling is how to fall. Jake Bentley with his best soccer impression.
1250 WTMA.
It's Charlie James on 1250 WTMA.
Last week we were telling you about that, what is her name? Jameel Harris over on ESPN. She said that she called President Trump a white supremacist, and they didn't even slap her on the wrist. They just kind of like said, okay, here's what we're going to do, Jameel. We're going to pretend like you were reprimanded, okay? Wink, 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 and everything will be good. Well, apparently the CEO or the president of ESPN John Skipper on Friday sent out an internal email. He said, I want to remind everyone about the fundamental principles of ESPN. ESPN is about sports. Last year, we broadcast over 16,000 sports events. We show highlights and report scores and tell stories and break down plays. And we talk about sports all day, every day. Of course, sports is intertwined with society and culture, so sticking to sports is not so simple. When athletes engage on issues or when protests happen in games, we cover, report, and comment on that. We are, among other things, the largest, most accomplished, and highly resourced sports news organization. We take great pride in our organization. Goes on to say, ESPN is not a political organization. Where sports and politics intersects, no one is told what view they must express. At the same time, ESPN has values. We are committed to inclusion and an environment of tolerance where everyone is diverse, in a diverse workforce, has the equal opportunity, and blah, blah, blah. So basically, he was trying to say that ESPN is not in the business of politics without saying that ESPN is not in the business of politics. So just another, just more double speak from those folks at ESPN. Of course, they'll continue. No, nothing will be done. You can say whatever you want if you are a liberal on any network, including ESPN. Now, speaking of saying whatever you want, I don't know if you saw over the weekend, there was this kid, kid's name's Frank. He had a dream. Frank had a dream. He wanted to cut the grass at the Rose Garden. That's what he wanted. He's 11 years old. Frank was 10 when he wrote the letter, but was also, he's turned 12 or 11 now. He enclosed a menu of his landscaping services, including weed whacking. All right? So they did, the White House said, you know what, doggone it, Frank, you want to cut the grass at the Rose Garden? Come on, brother. Get on up here. Cut this grass. Well, Steve Greenhouse, who worked for the New York Times for 31 years, still writes for the paper on occasion, took an issue with this feel-good story of this young man, Frank Jocko, of Falls Church, Virginia, who showed up at the White House Friday to cut the grass at the invitation of President Trump. Here's what he had to say. Not sending a great signal on child labor, minimum wage, or occupational safety. Trump White House lets a 10-year-old volunteer mow its lawn. Greenhouse also covered unions for much of the time that he was there. Unbelievable. Bill Kristol said the sanctimonious and humorless finger wagging of nanny state progressivism in one tweet. I agree with Kristol on that one. Sarah Sanders, press secretary. Frank is hard at work in the Rose Garden, doing a great job. Stephen Greenhouse. What this kid wants to do is noble. But sorry, I'm mindful of problems. I've written lots about child labor and kids being hurt by machinery. Tina said, teaching kids to be self-sufficient and the value of a day's work is problematic now? My dad had me on the tractor when I was 9. Absolutely. So that's it. But that's the whole thing. They do not want you. They don't want anybody. The mainstream media, some of these liberal hacks, they don't want anybody glorifying a hard day's work. They really don't. They want to make sure. Now, what if Frank, this kid, Frank Jocko, had wanted to be he wanted to come to the White House, or he wanted to go to Berkeley. He wanted to go out in Berkeley. And this kid wanted to teach a class on underwater basket weaving that was, or maybe women's gender issues or something like that. Would they have complained at all? No, not at all. They would have been all for that. No, here is a kid who is enlightened. Here is a kid. Oh, he understands it. He gets it. He wants to teach something that has no relevance whatsoever. They would have been all over that. They would have loved that. However, since this kid wanted to go do a hard day's work there at the White House, now all of a sudden there seems to be a problem. Boy, I tell you what, these kids out there, they would rather somebody show up at the White House with a clock that looks like a bomb than a kid with a lawnmower that wants to get out there and show that he's... I hope this kid gets so many people offering to say, hey, Frank, you want to come cut my grass? Here's, you know, $50 or whatever. I hope this young kid becomes a millionaire because of this. I really do. But, you know, you show up at a show up in school with a clock that looks like a bomb and you are all of a sudden a media darling. Show up with a lawnmower, and that's what we're talking about right here. That's what we're talking about. That's the philosophy that's going on in this country. Nobody wants to celebrate hard manual labor. Nobody wants to celebrate skilled labor in this country. They want everybody to be intellectuals and teach college and be a professor and get your PhD and blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. No, 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 no. We need more kids like Frank and less kids like the clock boy. That's what we need in this country. That's the future. That's the productive environment that we need in this country instead of people trying to make political statements all the time. Kid only wanted to get out there and cut the grass at the Rose Garden. So President Trump said, all right, that's what you want to do? Have at it. And then the president even went out there and visited with the kid. The kid was so busy cutting the grass, at first he didn't even notice the president was walking up behind him.
WTMA, the TMA Morning Show with Charlie James.
September 11, 2012, an attack on the compound in Benghazi killed Ambassador Chris Stevens, Information Officer Sean Smith, and two CIA operatives, Glenn Daugherty and Tyrone Woods, both former Navy SEALs. On the phone with us right now, we've got Brad Owens. He is with Taurus Solutions, Taurus Advanced Enterprise Solutions, one of the contractors there in Benghazi. Good morning, Brad. How are you?
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir. Tell us a little bit about what was your role in Benghazi and what was the role of Taurus?
Well, my role was I was sent to went into Libya with the team in the middle of 2011, right, mm-hmm. right about the time of the fall of Tripoli, and Taurus AES provides lots of different services to the Department of Defense and to the Department of State. What we do: linguist services, translators, and security services. And so we just kind of wanted to get in there early and be on, you know, on standby as the needs come out. Mm-hmm. Most post-conflict zones have a lot of things that they need support on. So we were in there, and we'd made some contact with the embassy and had a good working relationship with the folks that were there. And it was, as the security situation started to deteriorate through the second half of 2011, they started, you know, after Gaddafi was killed.
Right.
The Katibas started fighting each other, Katibas being militias. And so you had a lot of dust ups in the capital. There was a minister, you know, kidnapped, and then there were some attacks on some of the consulates. And so we needed a fallback. I say we, the government needed a fallback position in case Tripoli had to be evacuated. It was really getting that bad. So this compound that was in Benghazi was a consulate. It was like a fallback position.
Mm-hmm.
In case they had to leave Tripoli. Well, a request for proposals for a tender came out in February of 2012. And so I flew to Benghazi and visited the compound, did a site visit. And
well, let me ask you something. When you got to the compound in Benghazi, what was your impression? Did you feel like this was a safe, secure place?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's very defendable. It had very high walls around it. There was a lot of open ground between the walls and the house that was in the center of the compound, you know, more or less the center left. It was on one side was a main road. On the other side, the other three sides, there was a compound to one side of it on the east side. Then there was a road that had other high walls. So there was some bottlenecks on either side and a pretty open killing zone between the house and the outer wall. So if you had the right folks in there, yeah, it'd be pretty defendable. But it's not a hardened site. Now a lot of the houses over there are reinforced concrete. So they're rebar. So they're built almost like a bunker anyway.
Right.
And as long as you lay out your defense pretty good, you know, but you can't defend against mortars, you know, or 14.5 machine guns or 12.7s. So these are anti-aircraft guns that were mounted on the back of trucks.
Right.
And what they would do is they would just pound, you know, if they were, during the war, they would just pull those suckers up there and just pound something until it, you know, blew up or burned to the ground. But yeah, I think it was decent. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't ideal, put it that way. It, you know, from a security standpoint, because of where it was in the neighborhood it was in. It was a nice neighborhood, but it just, you know, wasn't defend, you know, wasn't, like, it wasn't near any military station, wasn't near the police station, wasn't near downtown. Like, a lot of our embassies are either out by themselves or they're near something downtown where there's already a lot of integrated security systems, you know, protecting other infrastructure things like government buildings of the host country. So there wasn't a lot there.
Now, you brought a force in there, right? Torres brought a force in?
Well, we were asked to. I mean, that's the part of the story that's interesting. We were the sole competitor for the bid the first go around. I was the only person that showed up for the site visit.
Mm-hmm.
And we bid for it, and the contracting officers that were safe in their cubicles back in Roslyn, Virginia, decided that, you know, they needed to have at least one more competitor in it. For whatever reason, we still haven't been able to figure out why. Because normally, if you're the only bidder, you win.
Right.
So they rebid this, and this, you know, small company that, you know, we had never heard of, and we've been in the business quite a while, had about 8,000 employees worldwide at the time, and so we all know each other. Blue Mountain came out of nowhere. No one ever heard of them. I met the guy who was on the ground with Benghazi in Tripoli, or not in Benghazi, but the guys on the ground in Libya. I met him in Tripoli earlier that year, and they had a couple of UK expatriates there that were assisting with the UK security. They had their guys stay in before the embassies, because all the embassies were burned and destroyed. And so they were staying at the Corinthian Hotel, which is a big, you know, nice hotel there. And so they had a couple of guys they had hired for them to augment their security. They basically stood at a podium and checked people's IDs as they wanted to go see people, and were there in case you needed backup. So they didn't have many people on the ground.
Right.
I actually have a business card from the guy that I got when I first got there, as a matter of fact. But so they beat us. They beat us by 4 percentage points. They rebid it. Blue Mountain bid on it. And it really surprised us because, you know, you have to submit a technical proposal and a pricing proposal. You know, how you're going to do the job that they're requiring and what it's going to cost the government. By far, our company would be, I mean, it's not even a comparison between, you know, Torres. Torres already had like 49 high, you know, security contracts for DOD, Department of State, other groups. And we had embassies around the world. We still do. And it was just interesting that this company, you know, beat us. They beat us by 4 percentage points. That is a 1990 law that requires that the government go with the lowest bid that's technically acceptable. Mm-hmm. So the audience knows that means like the bare minimum required to do the contract technically and the low bid.
Right.
And it was just a recipe for disaster. These guys got in there. They really didn't know what they were doing. Security started falling apart on the compound. And, you know, you don't have to take my word for it. You can look at the WikiLeaks releases that we, because I got into this and started investigating it. You can look at the WikiLeaks releases. You can look at the email exchanges that came out with the Judicial Watch email dump related to Benghazi. It's over almost 5,000 emails. And what you see is you see a pattern of the guys in the field sending these middle management bureaucrats and upper management bureaucrats at State Department, you know, all of these emails going, hey, we need more security. The situation's dangerous. As a matter of fact, about 6 weeks before the attacks, which is interesting, Ambassador Stevens himself sent a classified cable, which came out in WikiLeaks, that said this compound could not sustain a coordinated attack. It actually says it, and that they need better security. Let me bring folks forward. Go forward about 6 months from the tender being awarded.
All right, hold on. We're talking with Brad Owens from Torres Advanced Enterprise Solutions. He was in Benghazi. Okay, go ahead.
So about 6 months after the after we had lost the bid, and we didn't challenge it. It was a couple. You know, one of the reasons there was some anomalies with the bid process, but it was a 1 year contract, and it's only for about, you know, it was a little less than 800,000, mm-hmm, or less than 750. So we just said, we'll get another bite at the apple and we'll take a look at it next time. We had other contracts that were standing up. So, it was 12 days before the attacks. Our director of operations was at the State Department in Roslyn, Virginia, and we had won Pakistan, and we were have to have all these meetings getting prepared to stand up. They pulled our director of operations out, Jan Vicentainer. She is one of the senior contracting officers in diplomatic, you know, for over the diplomatic security contracts.
Mm.
And she's the one who ultimately would have made some decisions on Blue Mountain as well. So she pulls our guy out and says, hey, can you guys perform in Libya? And we knew immediately, you know, we'd already known there was a problem there, but we didn't know how bad it was. And, of course, we said yes. And so, you know, for every day after that, for the week after that, you know, our guy was calling them. Now, they called me, and I started getting the team mobilized. We have what's called a stand-up team. So when something like this happens, there's a group of us that have a lot of military experience, a lot of former Special Forces guys. They go in and help stand the contract up. We line up everything. So the team was getting ready to roll, and we were ready to roll within 2 days, 48 hours being told to be ready. We confirmed our local partner on the ground there, Atlas Security, was still wanting to do the contract with us. They said yes, and we were just waiting for the State Department to give us a green light to get in there. And unfortunately, 12 days later, you know, right after that, a few days after that, you know, Ambassador Stevens and the other gentleman were killed. So that's what happened. You know,
right.
That's kind of what's new to the story is that, you know, they tried to say, well, there was nothing wrong. We had no clue there was anything. You know, the line that was put out was that it was a safe and that, you know, nobody knew it was that dangerous. But if you look at their own words and their own cables from the guys at the ground back, and then you look at the situation, you know, these contracted people knew they made a mistake by picking Blue Mountain. So they came back to us to see if we could take it over, and we were going to. And then before we could do that, the ambassador and the guys were killed.
Did they ask you to come in with unarmed security guards?
Well, yeah, that was, you know, actually, this is one of the curious things about the last administration. I don't want to be political because I don't want to turn, you know, again, this has been too political from the beginning. I think that's why we've had no justice for Benghazi.
Right.
So let's take the politics out for a minute and just look at it and say that there was a policy in place under the previous administration that believed in what was called soft power. You know, it's what they referred to it as. And they wanted to present a less aggressive appearance, you know, outwardly at all of our embassies. As a matter of fact, this same contracting officer, Jan Vissentainer, and her boss, Sharon James, asked us to voluntarily disarm two of our armed contracts for that very reason. One was Panama, one was Peru. We still have the contract in both places. And they're still armed, by the way, because we refused to do it. Mm-hmm. We would have to agree for the contract to be modified. But we asked, you know, why, and the purpose was to present a less aggressive image, you know, which I think is ridiculous because it shows a fundamental misunderstanding of what the purpose of the security is.
Right.
Which is to present a hard target, is to be a deterrent. The only thing that we can do, and, you know, security is not, we're not diplomats. Okay. We're not there to be friendly. We're there with one single mission, which is to be an obstacle between actors, bad actors who want to do bad things to our people, and the opportunity to do them. That's the purpose of security. That's
right.
It in a nutshell.
Now, were you told to keep quiet about this?
Well, it was a little more than told. We were instructed with a very, well, not so veiled implied threat, as a matter of fact. Our CEO is a hands-on CEO. As a matter of fact, after he did the Tucker Carlson interview, which, you know, if you're, any of your listeners want to find the story, you know, you can go to Fox News and look at it. He's back in, you know, he's back in South America right now, you know, working on another contract. That's just how he is. So, you know, they called him back from overseas, and usually when we have to go to State Department for something, we have to bring some paperwork, or, you know, we have to discuss an issue. That's why we're going.
Right.
They said, don't worry, just come, just, you know, talk about it when we get here. So Jerry flew all the way back, I want to say from Zambia in Africa, somewhere, wherever we were. He flew back for this meeting, and he goes in, he said, it was just a benign meeting. He said, there was no issues. He introduced us to a couple of new people, which he could have done via emails, no big deal. And so he didn't understand what the big deal was, why he had to fly all the way back around the world. But on the way out, right before you get to the security turnstiles at the SA-20, which is the Roslyn, Virginia building where, you know, State Department security contracting is, Jan Vissentainer pulled him aside, and I'm paraphrasing, but I wasn't there, but this is what was relayed to me the next day. He said, you know, Jan Vissentainer said, hey, Jerry, you know, we're gonna need you to be on the same sheet of music with us, and you're going to be in lockstep with us on this Benghazi thing. And it kind of took Jerry by surprise.
Sure.
You know, we hadn't thought about it, you know, and he didn't say anything. And she said, yes. He says, listen, we appreciate if you don't talk to the press or anyone else, you know, asking questions about this. And, you know, Jerry, y'all been winning a lot of contracts with us, and you've been doing a good job with us. We want to try to keep it that way, so we need you to be a team player here with us, okay?
Right, yeah.
And then she said, but if you have to call, in other words, if you were subpoenaed, is what she meant, if you have to say something, you have to please go along with us that this should have been an unarmed contract, which, of course, given our technical proposal, was ludicrous that we had put in. So,
yeah, because you guys, I mean, you wouldn't, would you have agreed to an unarmed contract?
We would have agreed to the guards being on the gate being unarmed, but this is the way we handled it in our tech proposal. We were going to rent a compound half a kilometer away, and we always, this was a small contract. We weren't really going to make any money on it, but it would have been a foot in the door to the larger embassy compound later is the way we looked at it.
Right.
So we were going to have we had six Americans that would have been on the ground. They were all former Special Forces guys. I was 25 years of service. I was in my detachment support for Special Forces a lot of my career. And so one of the things were, we had our own Katibas, militias that we'd been working with in Tripoli and in the eastern or the western part of the country, you know, as the forward line of troops collapsed on Gaddafi earlier in the war. And these guys were made up of foreign expatriates. These were guys who were raised in UK by Libyan parents that have escaped, Americans, folks that have been raised in Dubai, Europe. All of these guys were pro-Western Katibas. They made up a commando unit. We worked with them.
Right.
And so we had our own guys we were going to bring with us. We weren't going to use guys from the Benghazi area to guard the compound or bring our own guys. We would have had a quick reaction force of about 20 guys that was made up of the guard members. And all of these guys were militia members. So their weapons would have been on our compound, not on the government compound. So if something had happened, they would have had their weapons, and they would have been living there. They wouldn't have been local guys. They would have been living on our compound with us the whole time. So if you look at what we proposed, I can safely say with a great degree of certainty that had we been given the contract, then the ambassador and Smith and Doherty and Woods would still be alive today.
There you go. That's the bottom line. Brad, I appreciate you being on the program this morning. Thank you so much.
Listen, thanks for giving me an opportunity to talk to Charleston. I used to be in 321st Infantry down in the Joint Naval Air Base. I used to drill down there with you guys. Love Charleston. Great town you got. And I'm from Augusta, Georgia.
Hey, I'm from Augusta, Georgia.
Yeah, I know. I just wanted to say hey from a hometown boy to another.
There you go.
Thank you for this opportunity to talk to your listeners. Thank you for taking this matter very seriously.
Well, thank you, Brad. We appreciate it. Thank you very much. Brad Owens with Taurus Security Solutions.